One, two, three, come with me, Bop, and you'll be Bop, in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
We'll begin
now with a spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and
view it. Oh,
anything you want to
do,
want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. First, I want to wish you happy holidays. Then I do want to mention that this is a sober occasion, and in honor of the great soul, Nelson Mandela, I spoke to a poet of my acquaintance, Miss Lillian Taylor, who is an artist, singer, and attorney, and asked her if she would share some of her thoughts about Nelson Mandela. And here she is.
Ladies and gentlemen, PNN would like to welcome author and attorney Lillian Taylor.
Hi, Rick.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
In this project where we're having women discuss the important issues of 2013-2014, you've written a very thoughtful tribute. I thought it'd be wonderful you could share that. So, ladies and gentlemen, Lillian Taylor, author and attorney, with this thoughtful piece.
Nelson Mandela. Yes, the father of a nation, perhaps of a continent. Yes, the preeminent world leader and humanitarian. But what meaning has Nelson Mandela to us on an individual level? He is at once our past and a critical guiding post into our future. A voice so important as his, so compassionate in a world beset with heartless violence, must be amplified. A flaming light of wisdom in a time filled with twisted tongues, fooling the unsuspected and betraying the public trust, must be carried forth. With courage so fiercely directed, Mandela proved that we have power beyond our capacity to comprehend. That kind of fierce courage must continue to inspire and bring hope to the far too many who suffer awful affronts to basic dignity. Without, we will all be bereft of hope. We must see that this does not happen. You may ask, but who am I to try walk in Nelson Mandela's footsteps? Likely, no one. Likely, you are, as I am, but an ant. But together, we are a colony. United in individual and relentless compassion, our colony becomes a mighty collective. Collectively determined that Mandela's wisdom, compassion, and example will dominate, we are contagious. You know that kind, the, check that out. That stranger smiled and said hello in passing. I wasn't expecting that. Now I feel better, and I'm smiling. That kind of contagion. The genuinely generous to someone in true need kind, and then you really feel deep down good about yourself. The not abusing our liberties to exercise disrespect, but the respect for the liberties and differences of the people around us, and in consequence, living in a peaceful world, kind of contagion, the social contract. Reflecting back over this past year, thankfully, we can see these dynamics in action. I want to preface these reflections by sharing three of Mandela's many pearls of wisdom. The first, I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison. And the second, which I didn't even know or had forgotten was from his mouth, although I've heard it time and again, resentment is like drinking poison and expecting your enemies to get sick. Nowhere have I seen the spirited determination to quit the prison and discard the resentment than in hard-hit Detroit. I am thrilled by the emerging renaissance that is overtaking Detroit. Now that's a... My socks are threadbare and there is no heat, So I'm stripping fibers from plants, twisting and beating them into yarn, putting my yarn on a loom, and weaving myself a warm pair of socks kind of contagion, a collective self-reliant determination. Another of my favorite Mandela quotes, overcoming poverty is not a task of charity, it is an act of justice. Like slavery and apartheid, poverty is not natural, it is man-made, and it can be overcome and eradicated by the actions of human beings. Sometimes it falls on a great generation. Sometimes it falls on a generation to be great. You can be that great generation. Let your greatness blossom. Well, the spirit to be economically just is alive and thriving in the papacy. Pope Francis is making no bones about it. Greed does not rule. Greed wrecks. So maybe contagion isn't really the right word, having a negative connotation. Maybe insulated is better, or inoculated, or empowered. But does the label matter when the substance is the essential? For those who knew him personally and will miss him dearly, I'm saddened by Mandela's passing. But we are blessed by this milestone with the opportunity to be reminded of our duty. We can assure that Mandela's work is expanded and that his example continues to shine for generations. One step at a time, in the same direction, being a helpful hand when needed, adding one contagious smile at a time, or by the handful if the chance arises, but essentially, always remember Mandela. Nelson Mandela was born July 18th in 1998, as was my mother. And I'd like to add a little something about the both of them and the ways that they've impacted my life. My fortune was such that I had profound experience because of both of these people. Both stared down the barrel of racial injustice and with graceful resolve refused to flinch. Neither accepted limitations in the capacity for growth of another human being. They were tremendous examples. I remember when the entirety of the UC system decided to divest from South Africa until there was an end to apartheid, all that is except my campus, which was privately endowed. I remember that funds earmarked for students who had been disadvantaged by race, sex, age, or social class, or even economically, had been diverted by that institution to purchase the largest Rockwell collection in history. I remember feeling kicked in the gut by a teacher who referred to the African descendants among us as darkies, who wouldn't teach the crime of rape as it wasn't an important crime, in his words. I remember having the perfect opportunity to accidentally run him over with my car, laying asunder his tyranny, while I was descending a steep San Francisco hill as he crossed the street. And I remember refusing the temptation. Years later, I set up in the wilderness overnight in a large circle of prayer, each in our turn speaking. I took my turn in recognition of the similarities of our struggles despite our differences in race. Reflected on the empathy we need to have for each other and asked that we unite as a soul and harmonious spirit to overcome the imprisonment of Mandela. I will forever be awestruck that the next communication with the electronic world was news of Mandela's release.
Thank you so very much, Lillian. That was beautiful.
Hey, thank you, Rick. I'm glad to have had the opportunity to share it.
can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. I'll put my guns in the ground.
Was the voice of Warren Zevon and his band, another artist who left early. And I thought that was appropriate for Nelson Mandela, a man who worked for his people, who went to war, but ultimately decided that peace was far more valuable for his people and his country. Also, this is the day we remember that John Lennon was taken. A sad day for that as well. But let's celebrate these people, these fine artists, the great man, Nelson Mandela. And now, before we start the rest of our show, I do want to mention the fine women that will be with us tonight. You've already heard from Lily and Taylor. Next, we'll be hearing from Harriet Haywood, who is a woman activist whose very, very hard work is focusing on the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, which you've heard so many times on the show. She's going to give us an update on the TPP, what's going on today. Then we'll be hearing from Meredith Ackman, Vice President of NOW for the state of Florida. We'll be hearing from Anita Stewart, water quality activist and journalist. We'll also be hearing from Jean Economos, who is with the Farm Workers Alliance, and then Ann Fonfa, who is a tremendous warrior in the battle against cancer. So now, Harriet Haywood, and the TPP, this update. Good morning, Harriet.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Very good, very good. And yourself?
I'm good, thanks.
You know, I really want to thank you for joining us for this discussion of events of 2013 and 2014 coming up. I know you're a woman who's an activist in so many areas, but let's focus on the TPP.
Okay.
What can you tell us about where the state of TPP affairs are?
Okay, first of all, I wanted to say regarding TPP, I'm sure most people on the show really understand a lot of what's happening with this agreement, but for the few that may not.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want to say that the TPP is an ultra-secretive, undemocratic trade agreement that is being pushed at the behest of transnational corporations by President Obama and the U.S. Trade Representative. It's an enormous agreement, and there are 12 participating nations, all Pacific Rim countries like Vietnam, Singapore, Brunei, Japan, Malaysia, New Zealand, and that's just to name a few. But it's important to note that it is a docking agreement, so any number of nations will become members. The focus of the negotiations is to set up binding resolutions between signing nations that would allow these huge corporate entities to override national sovereignty on what are called trade barriers. Trade barriers are, you know, anything that will come in the way of corporate profit, including labor and minimum wage laws, environmental laws that currently protect our water, air, land, and patent extensions on prescription drugs, the elimination of affordable generic medications, internet freedoms, food labeling laws, and financial deregulations. Basically, pretty much anything that would interfere with a corporation's expected profits. Corporations under these agreements are basically nation-state entities, and when projected profits are threatened by, say, a labor law, the corporate entities will sue nations for damages.
Now, in a way,
sure.
If I can interrupt for a second, in a way, these are actually supranational because they need respond to no state or federal or municipal. They need to respond to no governmental action. Isn't that correct?
Right. What they operate under is a system of corporate tribunals. They are totally beyond our court control in this country. Once these resolutions have been signed by the member countries, they are a binding resolution. And for example, right now, we have corporations that are suing governments under Chapter 11 of NAFTA, which, you know, these big trade agreements, TPP and the European version, TTIP, you know, they are expanding on NAFTA. That's why they're basically called NAFTA on steroids. And some examples of what's happening right now, Bayer is suing the government of France over its banning of a pesticide that kills bees. Eli Lilly, the giant drug company, is suing the government of Canada to extend a patent on a drug where the patent expires in 2016. Drug patents, as we know, is a huge business, and it's going to really affect Floridians, as we have so many retirees in this country, and they really rely on affordable generics. So extending the patents will actually do away with generic medications, and that's scary. Also, you know, tobacco giant Philip Morris is suing the government of Australia over its tobacco labeling laws. Because they want to overrule Australians' campaign to curb teen smoking. And, you know, I think you might remember that was one of the earlier cases in this country that came to light when Michael Bloomberg actually criticized that aspect of the TPP. So, I mean, the TPP is such a huge trade agreement with so many different facets, and really we only know about it through leaked text, which, you know, I want to add is actually the worst part of this agreement, is the secretiveness of it. It is a totally secret pact that has been only communicated between these 600 corporate advisors, the U.S. Trade Representative, and our own President Obama, who is pushing very hard to get this deal through. So, you know, TPP is so bad. If it is openly debated on the House floor, it's going to fail, right? I mean, right? Our representatives are working for us, right? It will be openly debated, and they will vote against it, right?
Well, we can hope.
You know, Rick, turns out that's where the problem comes in, right? The president and the trade representatives are pressuring Congress, no surprise there, to give the president trade promotion authority or fast track. So that is the focus right now, because as former trade representative Ron Kirk said, you know, we've got to get fast track to get this through, because if the people see what's in this bill, it'll never pass. You know, it'll never pass. So fast track, I'll just talk a little bit about that right
Please
now.
Please do, no problem.
I know I only have 10 minutes, so.
Oh, listen.
And it's such a huge issue.
If you need to take 15, you can take 15, trust me.
Okay, thank you.
I know
you.
The producer.
Oh, yeah, I guess you do, don't you? Okay, good one. Okay, Fast Track is a procedure which was enacted originally under President Nixon in 1974, and it was originally passed to give the president more power to negotiate with foreign nations. You know, usually, and, you know, initially it was mostly used, you know, for things like, you know, anything that actually had to do with regulating trade, actual trade.
Well, that was the theory, right?
Yeah, that was the theory. But, you know, the thing is with these new free trade agreements, we know very little has actually to do with trade. Of TPP's 29 chapters, only four actually deal with trade. The other 25 deal with what we call barriers to trade, which we've already talked about, anything that will get in the way of corporate profit. So the good thing about Fast Track is it expired in 2007, okay? So what they're trying to do now, President Obama is trying to revive it to get the authority to pass these awful trade bills. And they're working very hard, the U.S. Trade Representative and President Obama, you know, at the behest of their 600 corporate advisors, of course. They're working very, very hard to get Fast Track passed. So that's the first thing they have to do. The thing about Fast Track that's so awful with Fast Track, it's any bill that is being negotiated can only get an up or down vote. It can only have 20 hours of debate on each floor of the House and the Senate, and absolutely no possibility to amend. These are very strict guidelines. And it's totally undemocratic, okay? Fast Track circumvents the constitutional provision in Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress express authority to regulate trade, and instead hands that authority off to the president and the trade representative and their 600 corporate advisors, of course. And guess what? That's why they call it Fast Track. They changed the name to Trade Promotion Authority, so I don't want to confuse anybody about that, but we still call it Fast Track. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing to remember about this, Fast Track is only used on free trade agreements like NAFTA, okay? And the reason is they would never pass in the light of day. They need the dark of night. They need the secretiveness of it to get it passed. You know, we are all painfully aware of the consequences of these free trade agreements. All told, in the United States, 5 million good-paying U.S. manufacturing jobs lost, wages, benefits, bankrupt farmers in other countries. And, I mean, there's so many horrible aspects of it that, you know, it would take way more than the time slot on this show to go into it. I just also want to mention our legislators are always talking about budget deficits. They're always talking about trade deficits. Well, guess what? This is a major driver of it. Free trade agreements are bad. We've had 20 years since NAFTA, and we've learned our lesson. We don't want any more bad free trade agreements. We want fair trade. So what can we do about it in Florida? You know, that is the thing. Okay. First off, I want to say that we need 218 votes to stop Fast Track. Max Baucus has said that he wants to introduce Fast Track next week. You know, that's really scary because we are right now distracted with our families over the holidays. And we really need to keep this campaign as visible as we can. We need to pressure our reps to vote no. We really need to make the media recognize, you know, for such a large campaign, the mainstream media has been totally silent on this. Just for, you know, an example, just this past Tuesday, we had an International Day of Action on the day that the WTO was meeting in Bali, and we had an International Day of Action against TPP. And when I called and I had an interview and I had a demonstration down at the Hernando branch of the St. Petersburg Times, and the reporter had never heard of the TPP, and that really, really blew me away.
Sure.
So, the mainstream media has been silent for a reason. They are one of the 600 corporate advisors, okay?
Yeah.
And they are trying through the intellectual properties to get, remember last year we voted on SOPA, our representatives voted it down. Well, you know, that's going to be part of the TPP. So they are, you know, they're invested in this also. So it's going to be a lot for us to break through with the mainstream media. Our focus now is just to keep this campaign as visible as we can and pressure our reps to vote no, calling, using our social media like Twitter, having public-facing events, and very important, letters to the editor. The thing is, if we stop Fast Track, we stop the TPP. Okay. Now, I wanted to mention also that in the House, there were two letters drafted, one on the Democratic side of the aisle and one on the Republican side of the aisle. They're Dear Colleague letters, and they were to President Obama. The one on the Democratic side of the aisle was the DeLauro Miller letter, which basically is asking President Obama to not introduce Fast Track, and that the undersigned would vote against it if it were introduced. So on the Democrat side, we have 151 signers right now in the House that say they will vote no if Fast Track is introduced. Okay. On the Republican side of the aisle, believe it or not, Michelle Bachmann has a letter. You know, the thing about Fast Track,
it should appeal to left and right.
It does. It appeals to the far left, unfortunately, and the right.
Say that with a smile, honey.
Yes, you know, I mean, believe me, this campaign has made some strange bedfellows. But, you know, okay.
We'll take what allies we can get, right?
That's right. We'll take what we can get on this one. You know, Fast Track does circumvent the Constitution. It's very clear that it does that by eliminating the separation of powers. and handing Congress's authority over to the president. So we're working on both sides of the aisle. We have a total of 180 signatures that say they will vote against fast track. We need 218.
Thank you so much, Harriet. Before we go, again, where do they find us on the web?
Go to flushthetpp.org. That is the best place right now to go.
What should they search for on Facebook?
Florida Against the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Excellent. Harriet, you've been a marvelous guest. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And I know that your work has made this a better 2013 and a better 2014 ahead. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Rick. Have a good one.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
So that was Harriet Haywood, an activist working on the TPP issue. There's so much to discuss on that issue. The important takeaway, I think, for you is to call your congressman, call your senators, and make sure they are not going to support the fast track. Next thing I want to mention, we always try to support our good colleagues in the progressive media. These are homegrown progressive Florida activists, progressive journalists. Please, I hope you'll support them. Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy. Anita Stewart, who will be with us tonight, and her show, Wise Women Media. Susan Nylon and her show, The Nylon Report. Susan's a little under the weather this weekend. She did that traditional how many drinks does it take for someone's judgment to be impaired? Well, she did that Friday on her show. And Saturday when I spoke to her, she was a little under the weather just yet. So keep Susan Nylon in your thoughts for a quick and steady healing on that. Also, our friend Sita Bigwheel and her show, Sita Media. And, of course, Harriet Lerman and her show, The Voice of the People. Emily Dillick's project, The Progressive News, is on hiatus temporarily, but it'll be picking up in the spring. And I do also want to mention, since we're talking about picking up in the spring, we have one more show this year, and we're going to take the holidays off. Next week's show is going to be a show on the arts featuring some wonderful artists who I won't announce just yet. But tune in. It's going to be an amazing show. You'll be able to hear some wonderful arts information, some wonderful artists we'll be talking to, and I hope you'll join us for the last show of the season. Here we are 2.5 years into this project, and I hope that you're enjoying the shows and also being informed. Let me go on now and read some of the news that we want to make sure you are informed about. Fast track. Negotiators, the House and Senate, are nearing an agreement that would fast-track the sweeping trade deal the Obama administration is negotiating with a dozen Pacific nations, officials said Thursday. Such fast-track authority is generally considered prerequisite for achieving a major trade pact, as it would ensure that the package cannot be filibustered or subject to amendment by Congress, in other words, hands-off Congress, giving confidence to the foreign partners negotiating with the United States that any deal they agree will stick. Well, we'll talk about sticking in a minute. Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the guy who put the public health care system off the table. He and Representative Dave Camp, Republican of Michigan and chairman of the House Ways and Means, have been working on a deal for months. And, of course, since they're doing it in secret, you're not allowed to know. They're expected to bring it forth next week, because this coming week is the last week of Congress before their extended holiday season. So give them a call. Tell them no fast track for TPP. Okay, everything you know is a secret. Shinzo Abe secured final passage of a bill granting Japan's government sweeping powers to declare state secrets. The bill won a final approval of the measures at about 11:20 p.m. Tokyo time after opposition parties first forced a no-confidence vote in Abe's government in the lower house. First rule, the pending Japan Special Secrets Bill, is that it will be a secret, and what will be a secret is secret. And the right to know has now officially been superseded by the right of the government to make sure you don't know what they don't want you to know. And it might seem like a bad joke, except for the Orwellian nature of the bill and a key cabinet member is expressing his admiration for the Nazis. Just like Germany needed a strong man like Hitler to revive a defeated Germany, Japan needs people like Abe to dynamically induce change. How about that? This is from the Japan Subculture Research Center blog. The first rule of the pending Japan Special Secrets Bill is it'll be a secret. And what it'll be a secret is a secret. And the second rule is that anyone who leaks a secret and a reporter who writes it up can face 10 years in jail. A third rule is there are no rules as to what the government agency can declare a state secret and no checks on them to determine that they don't misuse the privilege. Well, what could go wrong with that? And even if they no longer exist, agencies may have the power to declare their information secret in retrospect. Fourth rule is that anything pertaining to nuclear energy is, of course, a state secret. So there'll no longer be any problem with nuclear power in this country because we don't know anything about it. And what we don't know can't hurt us, of course. Legal experts know that even asking pointed questions about a state secret, whether you know or don't know it's a secret, could be treated as instigating leaks and result in an arrest and possible jail term of up to 5 years. Imagine that, instigating a leak. Of course, the trial will be complicated since the judge would not be allowed to know what secret is that the accused was suspecting of trying to obtain. So, don't ask questions you don't know the answer of. What kind of journalism is that? Wrong question, 5 years in jail. And at this point, no one has really claimed authorship of the secrecy bill. It was done in secret. Kafka would seem to be the most likely scrivener for this particular legislation if he was still alive, but ruling coalition members acknowledge that another famous white man from the past may have provided the real inspiration for this bill and its implementation. I think they're thinking of Mr. James Orwell. Hey, George Orwell. Yep. Of course, knowing his correct name may also be a state secret. Let's see. Radiation high enough to kill you in 20 minutes has been recently found at Fukushima. But, of course, that's secret information. Outdoor radiation levels have reached their highest at Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant, warns the operator's company. Radiation found in an area near a steel pipe that connects to reactor buildings could kill an exposed person in 20 minutes, local media reported. The plant's operator and utility responsible for cleaning up the Tokyo Electric Power Plant, TEPCO, detected radiation levels on a duct which connects the reactor building and a 128-meter-tall ventilation pipe located outside on Friday. TEPCO measured radiation at 8 locations around the pipe, with the highest estimated at 2 locations, 25 sieverts. Now, that's not microsieverts, that's sieverts. 25 sieverts per hour and about 15 sieverts per hour, the company said. This is the highest level ever detected outside the reactor building, according to local broadcaster NHK. Earlier, TEPCO said radiation levels of at least 10 sieverts per hour were found on the pipe. Ventilation pipe is used to conduct radioactive gases after the nuclear disaster may still contain radioactive substances. Okay, next important story you should know. Guess who's cleaning up TEPCO? We reported this story last summer. Here's additional confirmation. The Yakuza is cleaning up Fukushima, neglecting the basic worker rights. Homeless men employed cleaning up the stricken Fukushima nuclear plant, including those brought in by Japan's Yakuza gangsters, were not aware of the health risks they were taking and say their bosses treated them like, hey, disposable people. We have those here too. RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky reported from the site's worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl met with a former Fukushima worker who was engaged in the cleanup operation. We were given no insurance for health risks, no radiation meters even. We were treated like nothing, like disposable people. They promised things, and then they kicked us out when we received the high radiation dose. The young man, who did not identify himself, told RT. The former Fukushima worker explained that when the job offer at Fukushima came up, he was unemployed, and he didn't hesitate to take it. He's now planning to sue the company that hired him. They promised a lot of money. They even signed a long-term contract, but then they suddenly terminated it, not even paying me a third of the promised sum, he said. While some workers voluntarily agreed to take jobs on nuclear cleanup, some others simply didn't have a choice. An investigative reporter who went undercover in Fukushima, filming with a camera hidden in his watch, said that many of the workers were brought into the nuclear plant by Japan's organized crime syndicates, the Yakuza. In Japan, quite often, when certain construction workers require immediate workforce in large numbers, bosses make a phone call to the Yakuza. This is the case with Fukushima. The government called TEPCO to take urgent action. TEPCO related to their subcontractors, and they eventually, as they had a shortage of available workers, called the Yakuza for help. According to Japanese police, up to 50 Yakuza gangs with 1,050 members currently operate in the Fukushima prefecture. Although a special task force to keep organized crime out of the nuclear cleanup project has been set up, investigators say they need firsthand reports from those forced to work by the Yakuza to crack down on the syndicates. Earlier this year, Japanese police made their first arrest, detaining one Yakuza over claims he sent workers to the crippled Fukushima plant without a license. Yoshinori Arai regularly took a cut of the workers' wages, pocketing $60,000 in 2 years. That was his side gig. Okay, moving on. Help save HB1 to label GMOs in Florida. Remember, the fight to get GMOs labeled in Florida continues. There's a House bill, HB1. It's a general bill by Ray Winkle, Vasalinda, and the co-sponsors are Berman, Kerner, Pafford, Peters, Pritchard, Stewart, and Zimmerman. This is to label genetically engineered foods, provides a list of commercial commodities commonly cultivated in genetically engineered form, requires DACs to publish lists by specific date and annually update the list, provide mandatory labeling requirements for genetically engineered raw agricultural commodities and processed food made with or derived from genetically engineered ingredients, provides for the enforcement of labeling requirements. Go Pafford, go Vasalinda. All right. Part one, you can volunteer. If you'd like to help out more and be connected with the groups across Florida, sign up at GMOfreeFlorida.org. That's GMOfreeFlorida.org. Make sure to let them know the following information. You'd like to volunteer. Your zip, city, phone, and email. How you'd like to help. Part two, call the committee. Stay today. Start today. Share and ask your contacts to do the same. HB1 to label GMOs need your support. This is the last chance we have to place it on the committee. Contact Tom Goodson, Vice Chair of the Ag and Natural Resources Subcommittee. Ask him to co-sponsor the bill because you need to know if it's GMO. What do you need to do? What else? Please contact committee members and ask them to support HB1. The bill needs more public support for it to pass. Out of committee. Every call makes a difference. Call and get others to call. When do you need to do it? Start calling through the weekend until Thursday, December 12th. That's the deadline to get as many calls in as possible. What do you need to say? All you need to say, my friends, is you need to know if it's GMO. And, of course, there's a script. If you go to our website, averyvoice.com, averyvoice.com, you can get these details, all the links, all the phone numbers, etc. Please help out. You know you need to know if it's GMO. Okay, Canada and the U.S. are busted covering up spikes in the Fukushima radiation. Hey, how can they protect from radiation if they don't know it's there? Both the U.S. and Canada has cut back on radiation monitoring after the Fukushima meltdown. Of course, why monitor it when you know radiation is coming? Hey, isn't that great? British media under attack. British news staff may face terrorism charges over the Snowden leak. Lawmakers put it to Russ Berger that he had committed an offense under Section 58A of the Terrorism Act. British police are examining whether Guardian newspaper staff should be investigated for terrorism offenses over their handling of data leaked by Edward Snowden, Britain's senior counterterrorism official said on Tuesday. The disclosure came after Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger, summoned to give evidence at a parliamentary inquiry, was accused by lawmakers of helping terrorists by making top-secret information public and sharing it with other news organizations. How embarrassing is that? Assistant Commissioner Cressida Dick, who heads London's Specialist Operations Unit, told lawmakers the police were looking to see whether any offenses had been committed following a brief detention in August of a man carrying data on behalf of a Guardian journalist. Of course, that would be David, Mr. Greenwald's partner. MP's questions to Russ Bridger. Do you love this country? Key extracts from the Guardian editor's appearance before the Home Affairs Select Committee over the impact of the NSA leaks. Committee Chair Keith Vaz, you and I were both born outside this country, but I love this country. Do you love this country? Conservative MP Michael Ellis. Mr. Rushbridger, you authorized files stored by the NSA contractor Edward Snowden, which contained the names of intelligence staff to be communicated elsewhere. Yes or no? Rushbridger. Well, I think I've already dealt with that. Ellis, do you accept that it's a criminal offense under Section 58A of the Terrorism Act of 2000? Mark Reckless, I think you have committed a criminal offense in your response. Do you think it would not be in the public interest for the CPS, that's the Crown Protection Prosecution Service, to prosecute, or should it be dealt with by the authorities in the normal way? Well, we've already seen what the normal way is, because after all, they, knowing that the files were online and up in the cloud, they forced them, people of the Guardian, to drive a nail through their hard drives. Wow, that'll certainly do the trick. Is Nelson part of the Gut Social Security Zombie Patrol? Thanks in part to the expansion movement, Social Security benefit cuts are all but off the table. But to ensure that Social Security isn't slashed at the last minute, we've got to double down and get every Democratic senator on the record in supporting expanding Social Security benefits, not contracting them, not trimming them. Senator Bill Nelson has not added his name to the list of senators who support expanding Social Security benefits. Will you call Senator Nelson and tell him you want him to co-sponsor the Strengthening Social Security Act of 2013? Nelson's phone number, by the way, you want to get out your pencils. Nelson's phone number is 904-346-4500. Let me read you that again. 904-346-4500. Now, in the news from the Middle East, that hotbed of peace activism, ethnic cleansing in the Negev Desert of the Bedouins. Thousands of protesters are expected to demonstrate during the days of rage against an Israeli government plan that would evict up to 40,000 Bedouin citizens from their homes and force them into impoverished townships. Israeli government's Prodder Begin plan, officially known as the Bill on the Arrangement of Bedouin Settlements in the Negev, would move the Bedouin from so-called unrecognized villages into government-planned towns. That's what you want for hunter-gatherers who are accustomed to a nomadic existence. Boy, I bet they're jumping at the opportunity to move to government-planned towns. The main protest was to be held near the Bedouin township of Hura on Saturday afternoon, while other demonstrators were planned on the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip and in several cities across Europe, North America, and the Middle East. The government is trying to present the plan as in the best interests of the Bedouin, while with one hand it's acting to destroy Bedouin villages and with the other it's building new Jewish localities in the Negev. Some of these are the very same places where the Bedouin villages stand today, Huda Abu Obaid, a Bedouin activist, said in a statement. About 200,000 Bedouin currently live in the country's southern Negev desert. Half of those live in seven crowded Israeli townships, and the other half live in 35 villages which lack basic services such as running water, electricity, paved roads, or schools. Israel says these villages are illegal, accusing the Bedouin of conducting a land grab in the Negev. The government says its proposals are to modernize the Bedouin and improve their quality of life. It says it's earmarked $340 million to be spread over the next 5 years to support community development. The idea is to better integrate Jews and Bedouin, to bring them more Bedouins into our workforce, and to employ and educate more women for employment, to build new communities and expand some of the current communities and make them modern. Doron Almog, a retired Israeli army general charged with implementing the government's plan, told Al Jazeera in August. But critics say the plan fails to recognize Bedouin land claims and ignores the community's needs. You can't uproot an entire population and urbanize it without consultation, and that's precisely what the government is doing, said Fadi El Obra, a resident of Rahat, the largest government-planned Bedouin town in the Negev. The plan has been condemned universally. Well, let me bring on a little bit of music while we're waiting for our first guest to tune in. What do you say? How about this? It's a little something on our theme of women in 2013 and 2014. It's a long-time special favorite of the show. And here we go.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Now I want your pleasure, yeah. All I want, just food for my baby, is to me my old job back. We work to build this country, mister, while you enjoyed a life of ease. You've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children are free.
So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring.
Call me green or blue or red. This one thing I sure know, mister. My hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No difference in them I can. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
There we go. A lovely tune. I don't want your millions, mister. And here we go. We got our first guest. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
And is this Jean?
Yes, this is Jeannie Economos from the Farm Worker Association of Florida.
Jeannie Economos from the Farm Workers Association of South Florida. Jeannie, you're a person with a lot of responsibility. You try to bring health and safety to our farm workers who are exposed to so many pesticides and herbicides. What's new in 2013, and what can we look ahead and see in 2014, Jean?
Well, right now we are very concerned about scientific studies that are coming out showing more and more how exposure to pesticides of the mother can affect the fetus and the second generation of children. And pesticides affect us all in the food we eat unless we're growing and buying organic. But farm workers are on the front lines of food production, and farm worker women are increasing in numbers in the workforce, and they are exposed to pesticides on a regular basis. And there's a class of pesticides called organophosphates that for years were thought to be benign, but we're finding increasing studies that are showing that these pesticides can cause endocrine disruption, which means they affect the hormone system. And there's a new science called epigenetics, which is looking at how toxic chemicals, including pesticides, can affect gene function. They don't actually cause gene mutation, but they cause the genes to function differently, and that can be translated to the second generation and children. And we're seeing that in children of farm worker women, and it is a real tragedy that we need to work to change.
Wow, so it's not just that first exposure themselves, but actually their children are getting it. You spoke the last time we were fortunate enough to have you on about how easy contamination, should we say, at the first level can be. When someone comes home from working in the field, maybe they hug their child before they get a chance to change clothes and clean up, or just tracking their clothing, their boots or shoes, or even bring their clothing inside the house, because these substances can travel with the clothing. Could you talk about that too?
Sure. Actually, the Farm Worker Association of Florida is applying, working with the Emory University School of Nursing, and we are applying for a grant to look at those kinds of exposures. If we get this grant, we'll be doing a 5-year study to look at pregnant farm worker women throughout their pregnancy and then to follow their child in their first year of life. And we're going to be looking at exposures in the field, but also by doing swabs in the home. Because a lot of times farm workers bring pesticides home on their clothes, but also a lot of them live close to fields, and they can pesticide spray or drift from pesticide spray can come into the home. So there have been some studies that have done swabs on surfaces in the home, like countertops and floors and furniture, to look at pesticide residues inside the house. And part of our study, if we get funded for this, which we hope we will, we'll look at that also. The good news is that there are groups around the country that are concerned about this and looking at this, and the fact that there are increasing scientific studies to look at pesticide exposure, that's the good news that we're looking at right now.
Great, great. When will you hear about that that study?
Well, we should hear about that, I think, in June of next year. So we're holding our breath to find out if that study will be able to come through. But I just want to say, I think it's really important to understand pesticides in terms of a social justice, an environmental justice, and also a woman's issue. Because, as I said, women are increasingly present in the farm worker labor force. And in central Florida, in Florida, we have a large amount of crops that are not food crops, but they're crops that are grown in greenhouses. And the plants that you buy in the nurseries, ornamental plants that you have in your home or in your garden, they have pesticides on them too. And it's mostly farm worker women that work in that industry. And in South Florida and Central Florida, you find a lot of that. And these women are in enclosed places, in greenhouses, where the level of pesticides can increase even more because there's no ventilation. So that's a very serious concern that we have. And we just finished a project with Emory University in which we developed a training for farm worker women related to reproductive health to help them learn more about the threats to reproduction and the health of themselves and their babies from exposure to pesticides. It's also a justice issue, and I think we really need to look at it as both a health and a justice issue for farm worker women.
I was going to say, a lot of these pesticides are endocrine disruptors, aren't they? They have to do with the fertilization cycle and the delicate balance of hormones. And when women especially, I think, are exposed, whether they're of childbearing age or still dealing with children, this can have an even more serious effect than, say, possibly on a man.
Absolutely. And if people are interested, they could Google critical windows of development. And the Endocrine Disruption Exchange has produced this great chart. It does take a little bit of time to load onto your computer, but it's really amazing. And they look at the development of the fetus from the time of conception until birth, and they pinpoint at the times along that continuum where different organs of the fetus are developing, and at which point they've taken scientific studies and they've overlapped them, and they show at which point during the fetus's development organophosphate pesticides can influence the development of the baby. And so that's kind of scary when you look at that and you see all these points at which a fetus can be affected. But it's very sobering, and I think it's something that all of us could take a look at, because farm workers are the canary in the coal mine, but all of us are getting those pesticides also from the food that we eat.
Yes, my family lived in the Redlands in South Dade, and when the crop dusters would finish spraying the crops, often they would just willy-nilly dump the excess before they landed. And quite often we saw them dumping it over residential areas. I contacted the county and state, and they said, well, they were going to write them a strongly worded letter. Have you seen any progress on the farmers' side? Are they using any less dangerous chemicals?
Basically, the answer is no, not unless they're forced to do it. But there are advocacy groups, farm worker advocacy and pesticide groups around the country that are working actively to try and get better protections. So there's two things I'd like to let people know about. One is that we're working in a coalition with about seven other groups nationwide, because right now the EPA is looking to introduce stricter regulations to protect farm workers. They're called the Worker Protection Standards, and this is happening right now. We're expecting that in mid-January or early February, the EPA will put up for public comment the stronger worker protection standards. So we encourage anybody that's listening that is interested to about mid to the end of January to go on the EPA website and look for the docket on the worker protection standards and make comments on that. So that's one thing that people can actively do.
Excellent.
And another thing that's very exciting, for the next 3 days, today, tomorrow, and Tuesday, leading up to Human Rights Day, we are actually in a coalition of groups that are doing a Tumblr action. We are saying that that pesticide exposure is a violation of our basic human rights, and we're holding the six biggest pesticide companies in the world accountable for human rights violations because of pesticide exposure in GMO seeds. So people can go to the Farm Worker Association of Florida Facebook page and look at our Facebook page, and then click on the link to Tumblr. And we're asking people to make their own personal sign saying that they want to hold the pesticide companies accountable for blank, 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 whatever they want to say, for, you know, poisoning our land, poisoning our water, our health effects, and then take a picture of themselves and post it to Tumblr. And on December 10th, we will be taking those, it's a pictorial petition, and we will be taking that to Washington, D.C., to the State Department's Bureau on Human Rights. So if people want to take action, they can do that in the next few days.
Well, thank you so much. That's great. Gene, I'm wondering, can you stick around a bit and stay with us through the roundtable?
I think so. Yes, I should be able to, sure.
Well, stay as long as you can, okay? I'd love to have you get some back and forth going with some of our other guests. We've got some really fantastic guests. In fact, let me bring on Meredith Ackman, who's Vice President of Now Florida, who's joining us tonight despite she's overcoming a cold. Meredith, welcome.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for mentioning that, because to my friends who hear me, they might not recognize my voice. I sound more like Suzanne Plushette these days.
Well, Meredith, I'm so glad that you joined us, and I wish you every chance at healing. I'm sure you were hearing some of what Jeannie was telling us, that this is a prime time for us to get people who want to help, who know the dangers of this pesticide exposure, to be able to do some things. That's so fantastic, Jeannie. I sure thank you for that. Meredith, you've got so many irons in the fire. No wonder you're exhausted. Tell us some of the things that you've seen happen this last year for women and some of the things that you see in the year ahead. Go ahead, Meredith.
Well, you know, first of all, yes, I've actually worked. There's more to it than only what's put into the foods itself. Like with the agricultural community, there's also huge issues with the Immokalee workers and other workers who are exploited for gains, and I'm really glad that Jean is working on that project, and she sounds like somebody we should have in there too. So I'm really glad. Thank you so much, Jean.
Thank you.
As far as things that are going on for now, well, you know, we've defeated some of the worst, the 20-week abortion bans across the country. In the last year, we've had some extremely incredible fights that we've had to fight, that everyone has actually, with the shutdown of the government and that sort of thing. The bright spot in this past year, as far as I'm concerned, is the continuation of same-sex marriage spreading throughout the country, and we're now up to 16 states, which is only going to grow. And it's so encouraging to see, because I've worked in the LGBT community for so long too. So it's really, I'm very happy to see that. You know, to close out the year, we're very we're proud to have supported the work of Nelson Mandela. We're you know, and it's terrible that he's not with us any longer, but we're really grateful for the work that he did and for the amazing strides that he did, that he helped to create and be for people of color and, well, for everybody, but about people of color. So I think those are some of the things. You know, those are the three hot spots that I'm always paying attention to. You know, this is the quick version of it. The healthcare bill is really, you know, I'm really excited that the healthcare bill is where it is and that we're moving forward and that 90% of people are successful in signing up through the website. And so things are moving forward. I think in the next year, I'm looking forward to helping a woman become governor of Florida. So I'm really excited that Nan Rich is running for governor.
What a tremendous
candidate.
After
that, oh, she's amazing. If you haven't, I don't know if I heard her on your show yet, but she's fantastic, just an amazing human being. So if you haven't heard her speak in person, it's really, you know, she's such a huge well of knowledge. She's been fighting the good fight, and she's been an incredible progressive for such a long time that it's really, I'm very excited by her candidacy, and I know that she's, you know, her campaign just recently revitalized. I was on a call the other day where she was introducing some of the people who are really fantastic, and her opponent, Charlie Crist's campaign is falling apart. If you notice that his campaign manager and, you know, advisors are dropping off like flies. So it's really encouraging to see that we're really moving forward in a positive way for her campaign.
Yeah, she's appearing all across the state. She's revving people up. We call her the little tiger around here. She's absolutely just remarkable.
Well, she's got a fantastic grassroots campaign going, and she's got I believe she has about half of the positions filled as far as she's looking for, but she's really doing a grassroots campaign where she's going to have like leaders within each community, each of the 67 counties in Florida, and she's really going to have us doing a lot of really encouraging things. So I'm very excited by it,
Meredith. I'm sure you've got now has feelers out in the legislative process. Do you expect to see another horrendous anti-woman legislative session coming up in 2014?
Well, let me preface my comments by saying that I absolutely don't put anything past the legislature in Florida. With that having been said, you know, this is an off year. It's a year where the conservatives are trying to run candidates, and I don't think they're going to be as much on the offensive as they have been. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they're not going to. It just means that they're going to do it more covertly. So, I don't expect to see as egregious campaigns against women as we've seen, but that doesn't mean they're not going to do it.
I did want to get your reaction to one thing I heard on this morning's talk shows. They said Republicans have been taking training, not just how to speak to women, but how to attack them.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, because it's abundantly clear that the conservatives shoot themselves in the foot every time they try and either, A, work on women's issues or tackle women's issues or attack women through issues, or, B, try and attack us anyway. They don't know what they're doing. And the interesting part about it is, like, I really think that it's fascinating to me because I think that we should all be treated equally. So I think that if there's a woman standing up there or a man standing up there, it should be the same conversation. Unfortunately, they have created such a stigma around trying to have a conversation with a woman that they don't know how to even approach it anymore. And so they created their own problem, and now they're trying to sidestep it by practicing. And frankly, I don't... I'd be surprised if it helped.
That's for sure. You know, I just find it amazing that this party, which is ready to assure you any second you ask it, that they're a broad tent. But, of course, they can't seem to stop attacking Hispanics. They can't stop attacking immigrants. And they certainly can't seem to find their way around the issue of women, although, you know, you guys do outnumber us.
Well, you know, and women, you know, to call women a, I mean, obviously we're a voting bloc because women vote, but not because, but all women don't universally have the same problems. So to say that there's one way to attack us and to do whatever kind of training they think they're doing is hilarious to me. It's just going to shoot them in the foot because it's going to make them feel more confident about something that they might not deserve confidence in.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, let me bring on our next guest. Are you gonna be able to stick around for a while, Meredith?
Of course.
Excellent, excellent. Let me bring on our next guest. Good evening. Is this Anita?
Yep, that's me. How are you?
Hello, Anita. Welcome.
I don't know where to start. I've been listening to these fantastic guests you've had on, and everybody's like fit together like a little piece of the puzzle of everything that's going on, and some of the comments that you just made in regards to women and women voters and the voting bloc. Women are 53% of the voters. We are the majority. And these men, these old white men that are in power for the most part, need to be talking to women and asking questions of women, and our input is so valuable. And I can give you all a quick example of going to
Please
a town hall meeting with Congressman Rich Nugent. And I think he asked, in this particular town hall meeting, he asked probably about 20 men what their questions were until me and my big mouth stepped up and said, this is a town hall meeting for men and women and for your constituents, but you don't ask women for their questions or input. And right away he did maybe call on maybe three token women out of all the men he had asked. So it's important that people know that we are the majority. And another thing I wanted to plug very quickly was the fact that the Equal Rights Amendment has not been ratified. It is not law. So anybody that wants to work with Sandy Oestreich, she is the lady to get in touch with in regards to this. She has been spearheading this issue for years and years and years. She's an expert. She knows everybody in Tallahassee. And we need to get this thing done. So I had to say that.
Anita, how are things?
Go ahead.
The other thing I was going to ask you is, on the West Coast, we're hearing more and more about fracking in the Naples area and the impact it's going to have on the Everglades. Have you heard anything recently about that issue down in Naples?
Well, I know there are some meetings coming up, and it's funny that you asked that because I pulled up the website that has the most concise information. And that is put together by the people down there in the Naples area. It's preserveourparadise.org. And if you want to find it on Facebook, it's the Stone Crab Alliance. Stone Crab Alliance. So
yeah,
I'm looking
had them
at
on
Preserve
the show.
Yeah, they're Karen Dwyer, John Dwyer, and so many others down there are working really, really hard. The other issue that's coming into play is what's called I think it's called the Road of Grass. I had a friend who actually went to a secret meeting. These meetings for these, these meetings for these projects are being held in secret. There's nothing transparent about this. So anything regarding permits is normally not a public meeting. But what has happened now is they're starting to section off the Everglades with this other project called, I think it's called River of Grass or Road Through the River of Grass, and they're going into some serious, serious burial grounds of the Seminoles and the other indigenous tribes throughout the Everglades. And this meeting was being held in secret. We did have an embedded person that did go down there, two embedded people actually, and they were having conversations and stating that they had let all the local people know exactly what they were going to do. The other issue is this is not a pathway for recreating. This is going to be equivalent to a major highway going through the Everglades. And the only thing that I can think of and that everybody else that I've mentioned to this to can think of is the fact that they're going to be moving equipment on this highway. So for the equipment and the fracking to take place, it's not just in the Naples area. The Sunnyland Trench, which is the actual oil deposit, goes diagonal from east and west from Naples, kind of like in a diagonal trail down to very close to Miami. And it's a huge oil deposit, but it's only going to provide a very short amount of time in regards to oil. In other words, it might provide oil for 7 days for United States. So it's not a huge trench by any means, but this is going to destroy the Everglades if this gets done. And what these corporations are doing is they're coming in like they're environmental organizations, and they're not. The other big issue that's noted on Preserve Our Paradise, I'm actually looking at it right now, is two applications for drilling permits in the Florida Panhandle have been already filed with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. So they mention here, as we place our South Florida hopes in the hands of our attorneys and experts, we will turn increasing attention to these on these pages to events unfolding in the Panhandle. So we can't even let them get a toe in. If they get a toe in, they're going to frack just like they're doing in Texas every couple of miles.
Well, you know,
and it has to be stopped before it starts.
It was partially out of respect, and also partially with just a tint of irony. I wanted to have this women's rights 2013-2014 because, in my mind, there's no women's issue per se. There are so many issues that women are engaged in and involved in. That's why I wanted to bring this wonderful spectrum of opinion here, because I thought just having you women all together, we would get some really wonderful synergies going and questions coming from these voices coming together and these wonderful minds and this wisdom. So we'll have one more guest coming on in just a few minutes, Ms. Fonfa, who, as we know, is a cancer activist. But let me go ahead and open the floor to the three of you now and ask you, do you want to ask any questions of each other? Meredith, let me ask you first. Do you have any questions for either Jeannie or for Anita?
Yes, but not yet.
Okay, no problem. Go ahead, Anita.
I think I heard quite a bit about the pesticides, but I was at work, so I missed the first part, the first guest. So what I'll do is I'll go back and listen to the archive, and then if I have any questions, I'll ask her directly.
Sure.
But this is Jeannie. I would like to say I see a thread through all three of these discussions that I think is really important, and I think it's important to recognize that, as you said, that all of these issues are women's issues, but they're issues that affect all of us. And the fracking issue is not just an environmental issue. It's an environmental and social justice issue also, because Naples is very close to Immokalee, and Immokalee is an area of poor farm workers, and it's also close to the indigenous Seminole Indians. And so what these corporations do, both the pesticide corporations, the energy corporations, is they target vulnerable populations with little political power, and that includes minorities and women. Oftentimes they, you know, minority women, people that they feel do not have the political or financial power to push back. And that's why it's incumbent on all of us to take responsibility, because what happens in somebody else's backyard tomorrow, today, is going to happen in our backyard tomorrow. So we need to all take responsibility.
Sorry, I think that's exactly what I was thinking. Is what specifically can the average person who might be listening to the show, what can they directly contribute to the cause? How can they get involved?
Well, again, in terms of the pesticide companies, I really encourage people that this campaign that's going on between now and Human Rights Day, it is a human rights issue. And we're targeting Monsanto, Dow Chemical, DuPont, BASF, Bayer, and Syngenta, the six biggest corporations that are in control of the pesticide distribution and manufacture in the world, and they're also in charge of genetically modified organisms and seeds. People can take action now, and it's a significant action because it is going to go to the State Department of the United States. In terms of fracking, people need to take action. There's websites, there's resources. I think it's really important that people realize that you can't just wait for somebody else to do it.
Right, but what exactly is that action? Do you want them writing letters? Do you want them standing outside with signs? Do you want them, like, what's the best way for the group that you're working with?
Let me chime in here. Go to preserveourparadise.org. That will give you all the information, tons of links, and research information, so you know exactly what's going on. And if you're on Facebook, go to the Stone Crab Alliance Facebook page, Stone Crab Alliance. And those are the same organizers. And also there's another event taking place on Thursday. It's going to be at the Central District FDEP office in Orlando. It's a press conference on Floridians' Clean Water Declaration campaign launch. So this is going to be like a huge press conference, and it's I'm looking at the Facebook page now, and I'll go ahead and quickly email that to Rick so he's got it.
Thank you.
There's also
Jeannie has go ahead, Jeannie. Tell him about that the Tumblr project.
Yes, it's a really great project, and it's a fun way for people to take action. And you can go to the Farm Worker Association of Florida Facebook page, and you'll see there the action, the link to the Tumblr page. And basically it's making a sign and saying, you know, I want to hold Monsanto accountable for, and then you take a picture of yourself holding the sign and post it. And if you go to that Tumblr site, I think you'll be really impressed at how powerful people's messages are. People who have been who have chronic health problems from exposure to pesticides have posted their stories on the Tumblr page. Organic farmers whose fields have been contaminated by GMO seeds have posted their comments on the Tumblr page. It's really powerful. You don't have to be a farm worker to take a swat at the big pesticide companies that are affecting all of us, our environment, our food, and our health.
Thank you. As soon as we finish the show, I'm going to go onto the Florida Now page and put the link for the Facebook page onto the Florida Now page so you have that, so more people will see it too.
Excellent.
Oh, tremendous. Thank you.
And this is a good time for me to bring on Ann, who's also probably going to talk a little bit about the effects of environment on our health. Ann, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'm here.
Ann, it's so great you could join us. Happy holidays, by
Excellent
the way, to all
discussion.
Of you.
Really interesting.
And why don't you tell us about some of the issues that, you are, focused on here as we leave 2013 and head into 2014?
Well, you know, it's interesting because my advocacy takes a lot of different forms, but my primary work is in cancer. And obviously, environment plays into cancer issues. So a lot of the things that were talked about, I made some notes, and I wanted to say that there are breast cancer groups that have been working on environmental issues for a long time. More than 20 years ago, the Breast Cancer Fund and Breast Cancer Action were founded in San Francisco. Huntington Breast Cancer Coalition and Rachel's Friends have all been active working to reduce pesticides. And there has been a grant through the NIH environmental, I forgot its full name, very bad with names, but there was a grant the last 5 or 6 years, maybe 8 years even, that's been looking at pesticides effects on pregnancy, on in utero, and so on. And I think hopefully the person you had on, I don't know if she's still on, who talked about the farm workers situation knows about some of that research. If not, I'd be happy to share that. I think that's there's some really important work that's already been done. Okay, great. The other thing I wanted to mention was you talked about a guest who couldn't come because she had a hangover, and I wanted to point out to people that drinking water and taking an aspirin while drinking will really help to reduce any kind of hangover. Really shouldn't have to suffer from it if you do that. In terms of my own work, I'm very concerned now in getting medical marijuana onto the ballot. Your listeners may know that 17 states and the District of Columbia have passed approval of physicians or other health practitioners prescribing medical marijuana, and very strong supporters of that. If the campaign is going hopefully onto the ballot in 2014, people may know that our Attorney General, Pam Bondi, has brought a case to the Supreme Court, and it's being heard now, and they're making a decision now as to whether the amendment is correctly worded, which is kind of laughable when you consider how amendments are worded.
Can I mention something right now? I'm sure. So happy you brought that subject up, because irony of ironies of ironies, here is a Republican administration taking the issue of ballot clarity.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
They should have been laughed out of the place.
It wasn't painful, you know. Yeah, it's ridiculous. But, you know, and I listened to the discussion. Some of it was actually handled live on the Internet or recorded in some way, and I heard the whole thing, and it's astounding what they don't know and what isn't discussed. I mean, anyone who thinks court situations are like Perry Mason, you know, has got another think coming. You don't get an opportunity to really say what the truth is in anything, and it's pretty horrible. So I don't feel like most of the real truth of the situation came out in their discussions at all. And they're only ruling on the language. I mean, they're not ruling on whether it's okay to have medical marijuana, but the questions were so naive and so simplistic about medical marijuana. And, you know, they don't have the right information. So we'll see what happens. But this has been a campaign for at least 3 or 4 years trying to get it on the ballot, and next year would be a great time to have it. But, of course, part of the reason is totally political in terms of wanting not to have youth or baby boomers or anyone else who might have supported medical marijuana, because they think, the thought is they're more liberal, and that would cause a shift in who comes out to vote in 2014, but we'll see. You know, in talking about women's issues, I mean, the first thing I wrote down was childcare. And whenever I read articles about successful women, they just had an article in the New York Times this week about how some women on Wall Street have stay-at-home husbands, which in my opinion is not a solution, because it's really just, you know, switching things around to the problems that ensued before. Childcare is still an issue. I'm 65 years old, and when I was young, I made a decision not to have children, in part because I didn't want someone to take care of my children while I traveled. I felt like, you know, that was just not going to fly into them having my values, and that's still an issue. We haven't really resolved how women handle work. Our wages are still 77 cents for white women and less for African-American and for Hispanic women. And that hasn't changed either. And the minimum wage, which is really happening, is also important. The good news is, for people with cancer, we no longer, as of January 1st, will have to deal with pre-existing conditions. And in my mind, that's the very best part of the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, because I spent, like many other people with cancer, I spent many, many years paying 150% of a premium that anyone else paid in order to get coverage for a disease that I had more than 18 years ago. It's ludicrous.
You know, I want to bring up another subject and have all of you react to it. We're all Americans in the world. In fact, I think more sensitive, at least for the last 2 days and maybe for two or three more days, about the incredible impact that Nelson Mandela had, not just on South Africa, but on the hearts of caring people across the world. I was wondering, how did this impact you? Did you see this impacted the work for women's rights, women's equality, human rights in general? And let me start first with Jeannie. Jeannie, when you reflect back to Nelson and Mandela's impact on your life and your work, do you see a connection?
Well, interesting that you should say that. Before I worked on farm worker issues, I worked on American Indian rights issues. And I worked on the issue of the Big Mountain, which is the Navajo and Hopi exposed to uranium and coal mining in the Four Corners region of the Southwest. And in 1986, we did a benefit in Orlando on Corrine Drive. And at that time, South Africa, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and the issue of the Big Mountain, Native Americans fighting for their land and health in the Four Corners region, went on a national tour. And we actually hosted them in Orlando in 1986 and brought the two issues, brought the issue of a kind of apartheid of Native Americans in the United States and apartheid in South Africa. And so that was my first really up close and personal with the apartheid issue in, you know, and Nelson Mandela. He wasn't here, but people from, you know, that he worked with in South Africa were a part of that tour. So it kind of hit me very, very close, and I feel like he represents so much. I think he is the epitome of what a real leader should be, and I think we can all take lessons from that. And I think the fact that for me, that tour in 1986 brought the South Africa issue to the United States, and it connected all issues of justice, social justice.
Wow.
And so it was very powerful to me. So I've been deeply affected by the loss of Nelson Mandela over the past
Wow.
few days.
Thank you so much, Jeannie. That was really, really touching. Meredith, let me ask you the direct connection between Nelson Mandela's work for human rights and your work for women's rights and human rights.
Well, I mean, I think that from my perspective, I think every activist, every human rights activist should want to be at least partially like Mandela. Like the man was able to change so many hearts and then change minds, and the way that he did it was just through an incredible grace that was intertwined with incredible messaging and the most amazing peace, considering he had suffered so much. And I think that's always something that I've looked to as my impression of him, and what I feel is his legacy. I think that. I think that as somebody who was in Miami in the 80s, in the 90s,
when they snubbed him,
I was looking for the right way to say it. Thank you for when he was snubbed. I think that there were a lot of people down there who had, who had a difference of opinion as to how to get to where they wanted to go, but I think generally speaking, we all wanted to see equality. We all wanted to see peace in the world, and he was the picture of how to create that, how to make that happen. I think that, rather than mourn his death, he lived a long life, and I celebrate that life. I think that it's really incredible that we lived in the same time that he did, so that we were able to learn from that and to see that kind of movement happen. So, I'm really grateful, incredibly grateful.
Thank you. Thank you. Anita, how about you? How did you feel a connection with your work with Nelson Mandela's efforts?
Yes. I studied him a little bit while I was working in military intelligence, and I knew at that particular time he was a political prisoner, so I had taken a look at some of his writings and, of course, was watching, you know, the different changes happening within South Africa. Unfortunately, what's happening in South Africa now is not some of the peaceful humanitarian things that he advocated for. And I think that, you know, most people, they don't tell you this on the mainstream media news, but South Africa is has one of the highest instances of rape and violence against women. Those issues need to be brought out by mainstream media. I know I'm bringing them up here, but when you look at the statistics, they're quite disturbing. So as Nelson has left this earth plane, Nelson Mandela has left the earth plane, he probably wasn't aware of these statistics and didn't know, but certainly while he was alive and while he was politically active, he was making great changes in his country. So I think the planet's definitely lost an amazing man of peace.
Thank you. And how about you? Did Nelson Mandela's work, obviously it touched everyone. What was your reaction to either his life, his passing, some of the stories being told about him now? I'd like to get your reaction.
Interestingly, I agree with Meredith. He had a very long, full life, and for someone who works amongst those with cancer, we envy that. But I was an activist from an early childhood, so for me it's all a continuum and human rights and equal rights, and of course I was a supporter of struggle against apartheid. I was active in civil rights, so for me, he was a definite icon, but I also was very, very sad when he and his wife had such a terrible separation and she was charged as a criminal and all that kind of stuff. I felt really bad about it. It seemed such a shame, and after he'd been in prison for so long, that's what he came out to. But yeah, I mean, the guy was, he was a very special human being who was really able to overcome tremendous challenges. And while I was thinking about him in hospital, I felt really bad that he was in the hospital for so long, because I don't feel like that's a comfortable way to be ill and die. I thought he should have been at least in hospice or at home with family, had so much family. I come at everything from a perspective of someone who's concerned about care and health and so on. So that struck me. And also I thought a lot about Stephen Biko, who, was killed because of apartheid and who died because of a complete lack of humanity. And that's really troubling. And then also I saw the movie 12 Years as a Slave, so I was thinking about how ugly our own country has been. And that was really painful. And I agree with the woman who talked about the American Indian situation, and certainly we haven't done very well in the United States in our way that we handle any group. I mean, each group separately has to struggle for their rights, and that's pretty crappy. So,
if I can just say a word in here, there's a really good video. I'll have to find the link and send it to you so that you can share it, about rape on Indian reservations and how it's a legacy of colonialism. And I just want to say just a couple of words that I think in talking about Nelson Mandela and talking about the conditions of women in South Africa and then bringing that home to the United States.
Sure.
On a deep level, I think we're really looking at the legacy of colonialism, imperialism, and patriarchy, and how that has affected South Africa, the African continent, and the U.S. continent, because it is the subjugation of women, the subjugation of the environment, for capitalist and imperial gains that have left us with this legacy of exploiting both women and the environment. And that's just the underpinning of all of this that we're talking about. And I think that if we're going to make real progress, we need to recognize that and then work to try and change that around.
Oh, this is Anne. I agree with you completely. And the Violence Against Women Act specifically excluded American Indian women, so reservations. that's a very, it was a very horrible situation, and that definitely played into the idea that rape can't be brought to court if it takes place in, you know, someone who doesn't live on the reservation. I mean, it's just completely incredibly bad that was shortchanged.
Exactly, and most people think that alcoholism is the worst problem on Indian reservations, but actually violence against women is actually the number one problem on Indian reservations across the country. Mm. So that says a huge thing, especially since we're getting kind of deep here, but especially since many Indian nations prior to white conquest were matrilinear. And so there's been a real shift in culture and consciousness because of, you know, imperialistic, patriarchal, conquest.
Wow. Very wonderful thoughts here, all of them. I wanted to go ahead and share just a thought that I carry with regarding the incredible life and work of Nelson Mandela. I've been an activist too for a long time in this silly life, and whenever I lose heart or whenever I feel the odds are insurmountable, I think to what was accomplished by Nelson Mandela and Dr. King and a few others. And when you think of the incredible moral force that helped that nation get through what could have been just an incredible apocalyptic holocaust of death and bloodshed, that he could pull that off, that his moral force was such that it impressed those people. I thought that's just such an example to all of us who try to do a little good in our life and times, and to temper those emotions and try to do something constructive with your time and with your words and with your life. You know, you've been going in so many wonderful directions. Another question I wanted to raise with you ladies is, you know, the issue of drones and drone warfare, I think, ties into the issues of colonialism and violence and war as a problem-solving, so to speak, tactic. Do you think that drones as a technology is going to make war too terribly easy? And let me go ahead, I'll start in reverse order. I'll start with Anne. Anne, what do you think about drones, and are they going to make war too terribly easy?
Absolutely. Our kids learn how to do video games, and the way it's presented is that it's just like a video game. It's really scary.
Thank you. Aunt Anita?
Well, being ex-Air Force intelligence myself, I can look at how this is going to save the military money, because you're going to have the attacks being done by remote control, and the person who's actually perpetrating the attacks, perpetrating the attacks are not going to be in harm's way, and neither is military equipment. The only thing that is going to go off and actually be destroyed is whatever ordnance the drone sends out. So to me, this is killing by remote control, and it's very frightening, as the previous guest said. When you watch the kids playing these crazy video games like Call of Duty, it almost hypnotizes them. I took care of a child last year, and I literally had to turn the television off because he was way too young, and he was playing with his brother's Call of Duty, and I went in, and he was like entranced by it all as he was killing on the screen. It was frightening.
Thank you. Meredith, your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I mean, I think that, well, obviously, I agree with Anne. I think that it's really scary for a couple of reasons. Number one, it desensitizes people to killing when they don't see the combat, when they don't see their own, the enemy, so to speak. But I also think that it will save lives of, on the other side of that, where we won't have to send troops and we won't have to send as many people into mortal danger. And I think, you know, I'd like to see something change where we're not using it, where we're not using death and killing anyway. But I think that if there's a way to minimize the dangers, that it's better. But I completely understand the other side of that, where if it's too easy to kill somebody from so far away, then it's not something that that I would encourage.
Great. And then that brings us to Jeannie.
Well, I think it's absolutely appalling. I think we're completely going in the wrong direction. If anything, we should be getting more in touch with nature, more in touch with our roots, more in touch with our humanity. And our science is outstripping our humanity. Our science is outstripping our morality. And I find it absolutely appalling that we would even consider just forging ahead. It's kind of like with chemicals, with pesticides and fracking. We are forging ahead with all these technologies and losing our sense of who we are as humans and perpetuating war. And I just find it absolutely, maybe I'm a Luddite, but I find it absolutely just appalling that we could even think of going in this kind of direction. And just, technology has become the god. Anything we can do with technology is okay, as long as we can do bigger and better iPhones and bigger and better drones and bigger and better warfare. I just find it so terribly disturbing. Not that there wasn't violence before and that we didn't have violence, you know, through much of human history, but to divorce ourselves from reality more and more and live in this virtual world, I find we're on a very dangerous path that just really disturbs me.
One thing I was going to say that I've been waiting for someone to hear to say, and I finally heard today on the talk shows, the thing that's concerned me is that for the last while, other than the terrorists in caves, the other big concern has been the suitcase nuclear weapon and the weaponized secondary or tertiary radioactive products and how dangerous have they gotten to terrorist hands. It seems to me to completely beg the issue. Of course, as we just violate international law, violate international borders, send these drones into other countries, do they not anticipate a blowback? And finally, I heard somebody say, hey, don't you think that if we keep using these drones, the technology is nowhere near as sophisticated? My God, I saw a drone for sale in the mall this past weekend. Now, granted, it's a limited distance, but this technology is going to be used, and it's going to blow back, and people are going to be surprised, and it's just sad.
Rick, can I add something to this? This is Anita.
Sure, please.
I believe that all wars should end, that drone warfare is remote control murder and killing on a massive scale. Too many innocents die from it, but even the fact that these are being conducted in wartime, this is the wrong thing to be doing. We need to be bringing our troops home. And the other big issue is I attended just this past year a meeting at our city hall here in my county where they were wanting to bring drones into our own community. And so far it hasn't been done, but we're very vigilant in this part of Florida because we don't want that to happen. And their idea was to use the drones probably to spy on citizens in an experimental program out of our local airport. So this is another thing, just like fracking. If you let them in, if you let them get a toe in the door, they will be. Then the floodgate will open and they'll be everywhere. So we have to stop it before it starts.
Well, speaking of a toe in, maybe we should bring up the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Go ahead.
I don't know
Go ahead.
If people are aware of that or not, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a supposedly
a trade agreement, and I'm no expert on it, but I have been involved a little bit in it. But it's an agreement. They call it NAFTA on steroids, and it's a treaty or a trade agreement that the U.S. is negotiating with some Asian, Southeast Asian countries, including, if I'm not mistaken, Indonesia and Malaysia and some other countries in the Southeast. And there's 29 chapters to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and only three of them actually deal with trade. The other chapters all have to deal with corporations, and basically if Congress gives the president fast-track authority to push this through, then it will actually allow corporations like Monsanto and Dow and DuPont, et cetera, to sue governments. It's one of the scariest things ever, and I highly encourage people to Google it, because right now, in fact, my understanding is that in the next couple of weeks, Congress is set to take a vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's really important for people to get active on that and to call their senators in Florida and call their congresspeople and tell them that you oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because all the other issues that we're working on might be subsumed by the TPP, as it's called, if it gets passed. So it's a really big deal, and that's another deal where we don't want them to get their toe in, because they're going to jump in whole with their whole bodies, and we're all going to be affected, everybody on the planet.
You know, as a matter of fact, those corporate suits, the corporations will be allowed to sue not in a federal court or a U.S. court or a state court, but in a corporate court where the rules of evidence will not apply. The corporations will be completely in charge of them. It actually subsumes national entities. So you'll be appealing to a corporate court rather than a U.S. court. And our friend Harriet did a real good story on that at the top of the show, and, of course, we always cover issues about it. Thank you so much for bringing that up as well. I do want to bring up one other issue where we've got some good progressives in Florida legislature fighting the GMO label issue. And I want to start with Ann. Ann, I know you've probably been exposed to a lot of information about the potential problems inherent in genetically engineered food and genetically engineered food products. What's the current thinking in the cancer community about some of these GE products?
Well, first let me say, the whole thing is very misleading. You know, when we say genetically modified, I mean, the whole thing started so that Monsanto could use more of its product and sell more of its product to farmers around the world. And that's what it began with. And unfortunately, they got a lot of support from the Gates Foundation, used to call it the Green Revolution, but it was completely crap. We did not need most of it in any real way. Secondly, the tests that are done really short-term. I mean, really short-term. And it's as though we know that if you study something for a month, you'll see the decay of the animal, so you stop the test in 2 weeks, and that's what's happening. Secondly, there's a tremendous amount of inflammation and allergic reaction taking place amongst our people of, you know, the U.S. and the world, and that didn't come out of nowhere. Lots of us think it's related to the fact that we're forced to eat not real food because we don't know what we're eating. People like me try to eat organic, but if I ever want to have a meal out with friends in a restaurant, you know, what am I eating? It's very, very troubling, and I think we're seeing the results. We just don't recognize it because in science, a researcher can say, well, there's no evidence of that, and people go off and say, well, there's no evidence. It doesn't, you know. But the truth is no one's studying it in the way that makes the evidence, and therefore there's no evidence because they're not looking for it. So we have real problems with it. In terms of the labeling, obviously they're going all out to try to stop state after state, city after city, but luckily some cities seem to be able to get under their radar and possibly pass some of these rules and to say that it requires labeling. And once we have it in one place, I think it will spread. There's some suggestion in the news today that Hawaii may have a labeling bill, and we're thinking that will make a difference. Once it gets going as labeling, we think it can be labeled elsewhere.
Thank you, Ann. Anita?
We have a very strong March Against Monsanto group here in Tampa that regularly meets once a week. They definitely get exposure on independent media in the local area.
and they plan actions, not just on the two dates that March Against Monsanto does an actual nationwide or global march, but constantly they're doing things. We have several nutritionists that are on board that will do talks on how to look at the labels and what to look for and what to eat and what's safe and how to shop and how to cook. So very, very active. I've been involved. I spoke at the last event in October, which was in downtown Tampa. And I'm all about labeling whatever we need to do. I know there's two groups here in the Tampa Bay area. One wants to do it by getting it on the ballot, and the other one wants to do, I think, a referendum. I'm not sure on that, but I've been hanging with the March Against Monsanto people because they're very driven to get this done.
HB1, the Florida Legislature. Thanks a lot, Anita. Jeannie, let me talk to you. Meredith, you're next.
I support labeling. I think it's really important that we know what's in our foods. But I have a long history of deferring to Ann Fonsa on this, because when I was president of the Palm Beach County chapter of NOW, Ann was the vice president. And I think she knows more about this than a lot of people that I know, so I fully defer to her.
Okay, thanks. And then Jeannie.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in Gainesville for a talk by Dr. Don Huber, H-U-B-E-R, and he has been doing research over the multiple years on glyphosate and GMO crops and effects on the crops and on health of animals and people. And his research, his presentation was pretty astounding. I thought I knew stuff before going into his presentation, but I learned a tremendous amount. He should be publishing his research soon, but through his research he showed that using GMO crops increases the use of Roundup, which is glyphosate, and of course increased pesticides affects the health of farm workers who work in those fields. But also he showed that after several years, crops that are repeatedly, for the first few years the crops might grow better and be more productive, but after several years it actually causes the good organisms in the soil to die. It causes changes in the soil composition and texture. And he showed pictures of fields after multiple years of use of Roundup, and the GMO crops were looking very shriveled and unhealthy. And animals, such as cattle that were fed GMO corn and soy, had digestive problems, and he links that to health problems in people, the increase in irritable bowel syndrome and colitis and other kinds of digestive problems that people are having. His research makes links to that. So not only do I think that we should absolutely have labeling like they do in most countries European Union, but also I think we should get rid of GMO crops completely and go back to non-GMO crops as much as possible, especially since 95% of our corn grown today is GMO corn. So you, anytime you're eating any kind of corn product, you're likely eating a GMO product.
Well, ladies, I got to thank you so very much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us. I can't thank you enough. It was all absolutely wonderful, and I thank you for the wisdom you bring us. And please, ladies, stay on the planet for a while, okay? We really need your help.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Enjoy
the show.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Good night, ladies.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. Don't forget, next week it's our art show, the final show of the year, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so very much for joining us. And good night.
Want to change the world? There's nothing to it, nothing to it. There is no life I know like the world of pure imagination. Living down, you'll be free, free if you truly
Good night, folks. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, wishing you a very happy holiday. Talk to you next week.